Hello and welcome to the Hi Hat Film Podcast, a comical and critical look at the world of film with me, your host, Michael Clancy. Back once again as another Hi-Hatter takes the hot seat and submits a film for consideration into the illustrious Hi-Hat Hall of Fame. This week, the film up for consideration is the 2011 Ben Wheatley film Kill List. But before we get into that, it's only appropriate that we take time to recognise and honour two recently departed legends of the big screen. On Monday, the 11th of August, social media became overrun with the sad news that comedy icon Robin Williams had passed away after an apparent suicide. As a child growing up in the 90s, I was obviously blown away by Williams' manic, relentless comic energy that brought films like Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire, Jumanji, and Hook to life. As an adult, I was almost surprised to discover the range he had as a performer, with roles in Good Will Hunting, Christopher Nolan's Insomnia, and a deeply, deeply disturbing turn in One Hour Photo. It proved, if proof were needed, that his talent extended beyond a vast array of silly voices. As is the case all too often when a talent passes away before their time, I've taken this opportunity to re-explore some of his back catalogue, and if you haven't caught him in The Birdcage or The Fisher King, then I would highly recommend checking them out.
So when did you know, like, that she was the one for you?
October 21st, 1975.
Jesus Christ, you know the fucking day?
Oh, yeah. Because it's game six of the World Series. Biggest game in Red Sox history?
Yeah, sure.
My friends and I had slept out on the sidewalk all night to get tickets.
You got tickets?
Yep. Day of the game, we're sitting in a bar waiting for the game to start, and in walks this girl. It was an amazing game, though. You know, bottom of the eighth, Carbo tied it up. It was 6-6. It went to 12. Bottom of the 12th, in stepped Carlton Fisk. Old Pudge.
Steps up to the plate, you know, he's got that weird stance.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, boom! He clocks it, you know. High fly ball on the left field line. 35,000 people on their feet, yelling at the ball, but that's not because Fisk, he's waving at the ball like a madman.
Yeah,
he's going, get over! Get over! Get over! And then it hits a foul pole. Oh, he goes that shit. And 35,000 fans, you know, they charge the field, you know?
Yeah, and he's fucking blowing
up. Oh, no, he's like, oh, get on there. God, get away!
No, I didn't rush the fucking field. I wasn't there. What? No, I was in a bar having a drink with my future wife.
Sadly, it was only a day after this sad news that it was revealed that one of the true icons of the classical Hollywood period, Lauren Bacall, had passed away at the age of 89. It's astonishing to think that Bacall was only 20 years old when she first made her big screen debut as Marie Slim Browning in Howard Hawks' To Have and Have Not. It was a debut that saw her work alongside one of the biggest directors in Hollywood history in Hawks, as well as proof she could go toe-to-toe matching barbs with Humphrey Bogart, and by asking Bogart's Harry Steve Morgan if he knew how to whistle, provided cinema with one of its most memorable lines. Not bad for a first big screen acting gig, it has to be said. Later roles in The Big Sleep, Key Largo, and How to Marry a Millionaire would later cement her place in cinema history. She will be fondly remembered for her razor-sharp wit, her distinct husky voice, and the confidence and poise she always held herself in.
May I use your phone, Mr. Marlowe? Hello? Police headquarters, please. Hello, this is Mrs.
Hello, what do you want, please? What? I called you. Say, who is this? Sergeant Riley. Well, there isn't any Sergeant Riley here. Wait a minute. You better talk to my mother.
Hello, who's this? The police? Well, this isn't a police station. Well, if you know it, then why did you... Look, this is not a police station. What was that you said? Oh, my father should hear this.
Hello, who is this?
This is the police talking.
Yeah, but she just told you that...
I'm the police.
Oh, you're the police. Oh, he's the police. Oh, well, that's different. What can I do for you? I can do what? Where? Oh, no, I wouldn't like that. Neither would my daughter. I hope the sergeant never traces that call.
You like to play games, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And with that, it's a mournful tip of the high hat to both Robin Williams and Lauren Bacall. Rest in peace.
The Hi-Hat Hall of Fame.
And I'm sick of the Hi-Hat!
Moving full steam ahead into this week's Hall of Fame submission, and this week it comes in the form of Kill List, starring Neil Maskell, Michael Smiley, and Mayanna Burning. It is a sick and twisted look into the life of British suburbia and the allure for violent men to return to a life of crime rather than live happily ever after. And to manage this, we need a sick and twisted mind to make the case for such a film. That mind in question is that of Andy Fenwick, a regular contributor to the Hi Hat Facebook page, who makes a case this week. Now, it's worth pointing out that the conversation you're about to hear is the efforts of a couple of different conversations. A dodgy Skype connection meant we had to have a couple of stabs at it, so there may be occasional changes in audio quality. As well as that, it's worth noting that there's going to be spoilers aplenty, as well as a smattering of salty language.
You're giving me indigestion.
Oh, sorry.
Apology accepted.
Sometimes God's love can be hard to swallow.
Yeah, no, it's hard as a dinner plate.
God loves you.
Does he? Well, tell God from me, if you're the type of people he hangs about with, stay out of my way. No more guitar, mate. Not in restaurants. There's a time and a place. And your time and a place is in a very isolated location where no one's likely to be for about a fucking 100 years. OK? Because Jimi Hendrix, you ain't.
And so you've just heard one of the many, many pleasant clips from the film Kill List. And now allow me to introduce the man who is making a case for it today, Mr. Andy Fenwick. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Mike.
How you doing, Andy?
I'm great. I'm just delighted to be here at Hi Hat Towers. It's really plush.
Isn't it just, you know, we've got these nice leather seats and we're reclining in our velour bathrobes. You know, I like to run an informal ship.
A snifter of brandy, and can I just say, Nick's ass groove in this seat is really comfortable.
I wish I hadn't said that. The lawyers had requested that his ass groove remained untouched while the ongoing litigation continues, so...
They had mentioned that it was sub juris, but I didn't really know what that meant. I just thought it was a racial stereotype about Nick.
Well, moving on, you're here to plead a case for a film to go inside the Hi Hat Hall of Fame, where it will go alongside my own pick, The Big Lebowski, as well as Princess Mononoke, Theatre of Blood, and Fight Club.
Oh, good. Well, hopefully it'll stand up against those luminaries quite well.
It's an illustrious list, and the film that you are submitting is the 2011 Ben Wheatley film Kill List.
It is.
Well, it's a film that... 6.3 rating on the IMDb after a vote of 18,440 users, a 76% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, with a 57% audience approval from there. So it's a film that's kind of split opinion, Andy, and I have to say I'm somewhat on the fence with this, so you're going to have your work cut out for you today.
That's okay, I relish the challenge.
Great. Well, as you know, we might not even get to that, because first you do have to, of course, survive the quickfire round just to prove your credentials. So without further ado, we'll fire off some of the quickfire questions.
Okie doke.
All right, here we go. First up, Amy Adams or Jennifer Lawrence?
Jennifer Lawrence.
Wayne's World or Wayne's World 2?
Wayne's World.
Romantic thrillers or found footage horror films?
Christ, they both sound pretty poor. Romantic thrillers.
Alright. Love Actually or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
John Williams or Danny Elfman?
Oh god, Star Wars versus The Simpsons. Danny Elfman!
Alright. Marlon Brando's Don Vito Corleone or Robert De Niro's Don Vito Corleone?
Marlon Brando.
Alright. Toy Story 1, 2 or 3?
One.
Meryl Streep or Emma Thompson?
Oh. Probably Emma Thompson.
All right. Avatar or Fern Gully?
They're both the same movie, but probably Fern Gully.
Okay. Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler or Hulk Hogan's No Holds Barred?
I've not seen No Holds Barred. I don't know how it compares with Mr. Nanny. If it's around the same level as Mr. Nanny, I'm going to have to go for the Hulk Hogan effort.
All right, fair enough. VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, or Betamax?
I'll just have to go for illegal streaming, to be honest.
All right, yeah, fair enough. The Hangover or A Hangover?
Well, I've not seen The Hangover, but I'm generally quite sick when I'm hungover, so we'll go for the movie.
All right, interesting. And finally, Adam West's Batman, Michael Keaton's Batman, Val Kilmer's Batman, George Clooney's Batman, or Christian Bale's Batman?
Oh, I'll go for Adam West's Batman, because the other Batmen don't dance. I mean, didn't even do the Bat Shuffle.
All right, well, a couple of controversial choices aside, I think we've established that you are indeed worthy to submit a film. So you're over the first hurdle, Andy, but it's the first of many. So why don't we get things rolling with Kill List? Why don't you start off by summarising the plot for us?
Sure, I'd love to. 8 months after a mysterious and botched job in Kiev, flabby house husband and mercenary killer Jay, played by Neil Maskell, is cajoled by his amiable partner in murder, Gail, played by Tyrus from Space, and is frankly too good-looking for him, if a little bit whiny, Swedish wife Shell, into taking on one more job as a means of saving his marriage, his sanity, and to fix the hot tub. Because mercenary killers have got bills too. Kills for bills, if you will. From here, Jay and Gail enter into a contract written in blood, no really, that leads to a road trip to kill three men. As the murders get creepier and more violent, Jay struggles to maintain his sanity, and we observe his descent into the heart of darkness. The film really ramps up the crazy in the third act when our dynamic duo interrupt a pagan cult, no really, in pursuit of their third victim. Jay attempts to kill everyone, only for Gail to be murdered. Jail is then captured and forced into a knife fight with a mysterious hunchback. After disposing of his opponent, Jay unmasks the hunchback to reveal, in a seriously what-the-fuck moment, his wife and child. Cut to black.
Yes, well, wonderfully, wonderfully done. Very well crafted. Nice that you didn't just go on Wikipedia and read off the plot synopsis there. There's a lot going on there. You've got domestic disturbances, you've got pagan rituals, you've got contracts in blood, you've got hunchback wife children being violently disposed of. It's a tough watch, Andy. And the question I normally ask is, why do you love this movie? Love might be the wrong word. Perhaps it isn't. Perhaps I don't want to put words in your mouth. But what? Why do you admire this movie so much? Why are we here today?
Well, admire is a really good choice, actually. I mean, I admire it because it stands up as a horror movie, and I'm not somebody who really cares for horror movies particularly, but I think it stands up as it uses classic horror techniques, and it manages to repackage them using contemporary film styles. So you've got, you know, classic horror techniques from sort of Hammer horror movies, which would be, you know, these long lingering shots, good mixtures of violence. It's got a wonderful soundtrack. I remember when you and Nick reviewed Under the Skin, and you were talking about these jarring violins, and it uses techniques like that to really set you on edge, but also to further the story. And the modern film techniques that it uses, it's sort of the first third of the film is basically a kitchen sink drama. It's slightly more Shane Meadows than Ken Loach, but I mean, it could fit into either one of those two men's canon quite easily. It then morphs into this road trip buddy movie, and then it becomes a revenge thriller, and it finally becomes a classic horror movie. I mean, really similar to The Wicker Man, but underpinned it throughout are these horror techniques that really reinvigorate the genre. We've seen in sort of recent years, or say the last 20 years, sort of people being quite meta about horror movies, either with the Scream franchise or, what was that film, like Cabin in the Woods, which, you know, it could either be a loving tribute to horror, or it could be a satire of the whole genre, depending on how you want to look at it. So they've sort of messed about with the concept of horror movies, whereas this, I think it breathes new life into the genre and it attempts to reinvigorate it.
Do you remember the first time you saw the movie?
I do, actually. I was going down to London. I was going to see my friend's band. They were playing their first ever gig, and they're a really great band. They make, sounds a bit stupid, but they make doom metal, and their albums are generally sort of concept albums based around themes. One of them was about sort of like the Witchfinder General, about a a witch finder who goes around murdering witches and taking lots of drugs, and his second album is about sort of a Charles Manson, Jim Jones style character.
Andy, I hope you're not using my podcast as an opportunity to plug your mate's band.
I received no commission for the very wonderful and purchasable on Amazon Uncle Acid and the Deadbeats. I received no money for them. T-shirts, I get a chunk of the pot.
Oh, those T-shirts are fantastic. I love those T-shirts.
The poly cotton blend ones?
Oh, so soft.
Oh, God. I'm just wearing one right now. Just, that's it.
Anyway, we digress.
Yes, so I was going down to see this really awesome band. And I was taking the Megabus down, which I'm sure you can appreciate is about the scariest thing you can do anyway.
Yeah, as if you didn't need anything else more terrifying.
Exactly. So I was all geared up for my 10-hour journey down to London on the Megabus, and I asked around to find something to get me in the mood for this seriously trippy, scary experience that I was hopefully going to go to, and a couple of folks said Kill List. So I got it loaded up on my tablet, I got my headphones all set up. It took me about 4.5 hours to watch this movie, which, I don't know if it clocks in at maybe about 90, 100 minutes in total, just because I kept stopping it because I was quite sick to my stomach. and don't get me wrong, it's not hyper-violent. It's not, what's the Japanese guy, Mike? How do you pronounce his name?
Are you talking about Takeshi Mike?
Yeah, him, is it Mike? Okay. Yeah, it's not as hyper-violent as that. It's not
Oh, well,
it's not that bad.
Thank goodness.
But, I mean, there's a guy getting his knees fanned in with a claw hammer or something. That's pretty bad. So I thought, I'll close my eyes and get through that. It was worse when I closed my eyes just because I had headphones in and I was stuck into this loop with the music. And that sort of highlights part of what the charm of classic horror movies are about. It becomes more visceral because it is it uses the power of your imagination more. Where in a modern horror movie, you'll see the bad guy jump out, you'll see them getting slashed or whatever. Whereas in this, it's so much more imagined, and it trusts the audience to interpret what's going on screen and draw their own conclusions. So I was on a bus to answer your question, Mike. I was on a bus would be the short answer.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a pretty unsettling occasion to watch it, and I can understand why that left the mark. Is it one of the things that is leveled at it, I would say, like doing my research, is it's a one-watcher. It's a one-watcher. Is it a one-watcher for you? Have you returned to it since?
Well, I got to say, I've sort of not forced it on people. Whenever folk have been around and said, oh, what should we watch? And after they've said, no, let's not watch Wayne's World again, I try and get them to watch Kill List.
That is unbelievably cruel, if you don't mind me saying.
Well, the thing is, we've probably driven over to mine and then, not to force them to watch Wayne's World, to force them to watch Kill List. Yes. Well, see, yeah, I get it. It's an experience. These are grown-up people. I don't hoist it on my nephew or anything.
Okay. So you're adhering to the 18 certificate that was put upon it by the BBFC. Well, that's something, I suppose.
Well, I don't think I should admit to inviting people under the event.
Yeah. Let's reverse back up that cul-de-sac.
Yeah, we'll edit out any paedophilia references.
We would, but I don't know how to edit, so.
What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, make people watch Kill List. So, yeah, with regards to being a repeat viewer, sure, there is a wonderful climax to it, but it's not M. Night Shyamalan style watching where you go, well, that's ruined, or even The Usual Suspect, which is slightly better, although I am interested in watching that. I Am a Ghost. I liked your interview with that Mendoza guy. He seemed a nice chap.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress. So if you watch it the first time, you will come away from going, what the fuck? The ending is pretty extreme and a little bit out there, and some might argue it ruins it. I don't. But I think there are lots of hidden clues in there to explain quite what's going on with regards to the secret pagan cult, which may or may not be controlling all the events that are going on. And there's lots of symbolism that works throughout the movie as well. I think especially in the first third of the movie, that's got a real child's perspective to it from his son. And he is presented as a crusader. In fact, at one point he gets rebuked by Gale, who says, this isn't a crusade you're going on. And there's lots of sort of St. George imagery running through it. The son's got sort of castle turret toy holders, and the staining in the glass is St. George's cross. And there's a wonderful scene at the beginning where he buys a toy sword set for his son, and his wife and his son and him go out in the back garden and have this sword fight, and the son climbs up on the wife's back, and it's this wonderful foreshadowing of the final scene, which you completely miss on the first time round.
Yeah.
But I do a little giggle of delight whenever it pops up, because even though the film's very clearly in three obvious acts, the film sort of centres upon itself. It sort of goes into reverse once it reaches a sort of halfway point, and that's a very obvious landmark. So I think there's lots of hidden sort of Easter eggs, I guess you would call them.
And when you're showing it to your unsuspecting house guests, do you get some kind of sick, perverse pleasure knowing that they are unaware, blissfully unaware of the horrors that are yet to unfold themselves?
I usually give them a little precursor and point out that there's going to be some pretty extreme violence. But that you can put up with, and that you can close your eyes for, because it's only on for X number of seconds. But I think just generally the tone that goes through it is really unsettling, and it gives me a sore belly, I'm not going to lie.
Do you, I mean, you've mentioned so many like striking points to this, and I think we need to kind of give director Ben Wheatley a bit of acknowledgement. Is there a more exciting British director working in the business at the moment, would you say?
Well, probably Steve McQueen, but if we really want to sell this, I mean, I could lie. There's lots of, I would say young British directors, I think Ben Wheatley's about 40 or so.
Mm.
But there's other folk doing wonderful stuff. Dale Corbett, Andrea Arnold. I think there's actually sort of parallels with Fish Tank.
Right.
With these really long scenes, or really long shots, excuse me, which leave you feeling incredibly uncomfortable. Fassbender in that movie's got wonderful, as he does in most movies, sort of psychosexual power. And it's really, really uncomfortable. But what Arnold does in that movie is hold the shot for longer than is really comfortable. So I think she's making some wonderful stuff.
Mm.
Stephen McQueen is 3 for 3 so far. And it'll be interesting to see what Corbett does. I think where there's sort of a divergence between Arnold and McQueen and Wheatley is that Arnold and McQueen will do very big movies, I think.
Yeah.
McQueen is utterly over. He's just beloved. And Arnold seems to be setting up to do bigger things, whereas Wheatley, after he did Kill List, he did Sightseers, which is a comedy, a black comedy, which is genuinely hilarious. I thought it was in some ways a better movie, or certainly more accessible. And then after that, it's really funny. And then he did A Field in England, which I think he made for about £250,000.
Mm.
And it's sort of like an art house film about four guys in the English Civil War who literally wander around a field in England, take some mushrooms, magic mushrooms, and just get fucked up.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful example of what you can just do if you want to make a movie. It's really, really small scale, you know?
Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, you have Kill List, which is this, like, blistering, eccentric film, and then following up with Sightseers, which is really dark, and it still has that kind of sickly, gross, violent humour to it. But it all that is approaching the mainstream with some of his stuff, and you would think that he was almost poised to like take that next step into a bigger production, and instead he goes backwards to A Field in England, which is just one of the most remarkably striking films, certainly, and very distinct in its look and its tone. And you have like that, it's punctuated by that slow motion sequence where its protagonist kind of bursts out of the tent after being, you know, possessed or what have you, and it's just, you know, that is, and you're just taking several steps backwards for any fans you might have won over in this in Sightseers.
Oh yes, it's challenging. You know, if you're Fleetwood Mac and you release Rumours and you come out with Tusk after it, there's going to be a few record executives who are pretty pissed off. I'm not saying that's the only way to make art or whatever, but it's interesting that he's. I mean, you were saying about Sightseers, how it's got this blackness. I think I read an interview with Wheatley where he said it exists in the same universe as Kill List. Which I think it's quite fun that he sort of pieces these things together, and there's a wider thing to it, whereas even if they don't interconnect, they still exist on the same page. And as you say about A Field in England, it does centre on it's just when they get high, basically. And it does, it's not a great movie, but it's well done him for trying it, and it's it feels like it could be a really good college film students movie.
Yeah.
Which isn't it's a bit of a backhand compliment, that, to be honest.
Slightly, but you know, yeah. Well, I think we know what you mean. A film, going back to Kill List, shot over 18 days, apparently in terms of the production they did one shot on the script, and then he kind of encouraged his actors to improv and develop backstory. And, you know, the film is highlighted by the bromance, if you will, that develops between Neo Maskell, who plays Jay, who, you know, if you get over the fact he looks a bit like Tubes from Soccer AM, he puts in a fantastic performance. And
God,
then
you've ruined the movie. I rescind it. We'll just do Wayne's World.
It's too late now. We're halfway through. We're almost there. And then one of Wheatley's regulars, Michael Smiley, is a girl who
Irish from Faced.
Yeah, I think
Irish
he's
from Faced.
Okay. Sorry, what's his name in Faced?
Tyres.
Tyres?
You don't know Space that well that you see that man and think Tyres from Space.
I don't know Space that well. I've only seen a couple of episodes of Space. And I think they just, like, their relationship, there's a lot of heart to it, you know, and when poor old Michael Smiley shuffles off the mortal coil, you know, you feel for Jay. He's lost his best bud and his companion in life. I'm making it seem a lot more lighthearted than it actually is.
It's not really. I mean, it does build as a bromance. It's not quite Riggs and Murtaugh or anything like that. But I mean, if you look at it, you know, really focused in on the movie, their relationship is there's the sort of dualism of I mean, it runs through the movie of good and evil. But Michael Smiley's the religious character, and Jay's character is irreligious and presented as evil or whatever else. And I mean, at the end of the movie, when he does die, he's the only one who's probably not in on this pagan cult. He's the only innocent in the entire movie, as far as we know. But I don't think enough could be said about quite how fine the acting is throughout the movie. It's all very, very good. And you talk about these backstories that they have created. You watch them on screen, and you feel as though that there is a genuine connection between these characters, not just the actors and the people playing them. The actual characters themselves do have a backstory, and you think these could have been guys who served in the army. And, you know, I was talking just a second ago about how the film is on a very large scale about good and evil, and Jay could in fact be the personification of the devil. But because it's rooted in these performances, if you wanted, you could say that it's an anti-war movie, because this is a guy who's clearly suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, his life is unraveling. He lives in a very humdrum Sheffield, and there's this sort of suburban malaise going on with the boredom of his life, and he drinks a little bit too much, and he's a bit flabby, and his life's gone down the shitter ever since he stopped fighting in Iraq. You know, it ranges from these incredibly small, tight issues, such as, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, all the way to the eternal battle between good and evil, and it's up to you to interpret.
And it's interesting you kind of bring up that side of things, because he, you know, having served in the war. And then I had the opportunity a year or so ago to sit down with a guy called Nick Gillespie, who worked on the film. He worked as the second camera, the assistant to Laurie Rhodes, who was the director of photography. And asked, like, what notes he was given when recording. Wheatley told him to imagine you were a war reporter in Afghanistan, running from tree to tree, just catching little parts of the action. So, like, that big climax kind of at the end, that's them right back in it. They're right in the only place they really belong, and that's in the war zone, and where, well, you could say that they're their happiest. They're in their element.
Well, yeah, I mean, once you've reached that, I mean, I when I was doing my synopsis, I mentioned Heart of Darkness, and that's Apocalypse Now. That's a short story from that, and it's that sort of thing. It's once you've been in the shit and come out of it, I say from my suburban Cumbernauld homestead.
Oh, we've seen things, Andy. We've seen things.
Oh, God, yeah. I live in Cumbernauld. I've seen things. I have seen things. But once you've reached that point and you have to go back and you've got to worry about fixing the hot tub. And it's this kitchen sink drama that it starts off with, and you get into the humdrum nature of it, and your wife complaining because you haven't bought toilet roll, but you ended up buying 10 bottles of wine. We've all been there. And how do you reconcile that? And it does have these very small, tight, but still important issues, and the big, silly, ridiculous G is the personification of the devil issues.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that you spoke to the guy who was second camera on. I like the fact that it had that war correspondent touch to it.
Yeah.
No, a repeat viewing, and I'll be having that going through my head the whole way through. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, no. It was a really interesting interview, actually, because he's worked with Wheatley. I think they were working on a segment for the ABCs of Death as well, which was like that portmanteau film that came out a year or so ago. And he just says, like, working with Wheatley was it's just like, every day it's something different, and you kind of have to teach yourself new technologies just to keep up. They're like innovators and always coming up with new ways of capturing that, and I think that really shows pays off here.
Oh yeah, I mean, you watched Kill List, and I was quite scattergun the way that I tried to describe it, because there's a lot to get in. And I mentioned that it's a revenge film. It's very much a Tarantino revenge film.
Yeah.
And it's kind of strange that Tarantino, who is the master of pulling together disparate genres to try and create a cohesive unit of a film, is now a style within himself. And Wheatley very much draws from that amongst other directors and styles that he takes from. But he clearly is somebody who likes to try his hand, and he's been largely successful at most of the things he's tried. I mean, Sausage is definitely a black comedy, but it's certainly a comedy, and it fits in with a very sort of, even though he's from the South, it's got this very black country verging on northern humour, and it's very, very deadpan all the way through. I know he didn't write it, but he still manages to pull that off extremely well.
And so doing my research on the show, was looking up some reviews of it, and the phrases that kept on popping up, as I mentioned before, was a one-watcher, but also a slow burner. And to me, that has negative connotations, and it's one for me, when I think back on the film, I remember the opening sequences more. I just found them nail-bitingly hard to get through, like this domestic unhappiness that they're living in, and it's just so tense and so thoroughly unpleasant. That is the part that sticks out with me more than, funnily enough, like the blood contracts and the pagan rituals.
No, that's very true, and it depends on how you want to look at films. I know that you like appropriately paced, but often slow-paced film, Once Upon a Time in the West, whatever else, things that are able to set the tone just right with the pacing of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was surprised when I actually watched it again and with a more critical view at quite how long, or how long in literal time scale, I think it's about half an hour for the first section of the film. And it's very drawn out, and it's horribly uncomfortable, and it's meant to be that. A director's there to manipulate an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You want to come out of a film, even if you've not enjoyed it, having felt something, as opposed to just some utter malaise. I mean, that's a dreadful film. You come out of that, if you've gone, well, that was awful, and you've got things to say, why it was awful, at least they've tried something. But with Kill List, it's a mixture of, it's largely centred around a horribly uncomfortable dinner party. And this is where it really ties into the early kitchen sink drama stuff, Alan Bennett stuff. And even without a nasty soundtrack in the background to leave you feeling buttock-clenchingly uncomfortable, it really does unsettle you throughout.
Mm. Absolutely. So we've kind of touched on the filmmaking style, the fact that it kind of spans over numerous genres. We've talked a little bit about Ben Wheatley. So wrapping up, Andy, this is your last chance. If there's anything else you haven't got in, why should this film go into the Hi Hat Hall of Fame? Not just, and here we're moving away from just like personal preference to it, but let's look at it on the bigger picture. Why does this deserve to go alongside in one of the most illustrious lists in movie history that will stand the test of time forever and ever for future generations?
Oh no, look, I take this seriously. Long after I'm dead and my bones have shriveled into dust and whatever else, this will hopefully still be sitting up on the mantelpiece in Hi Hat Towers.
Mm-hmm.
I think Kill List should be introduced into the Hi Hat Hall of Fame because, as I said earlier, it is a contemporary classic horror film, and even if those two things seem to cancel each other out, they don't. It's a film that manages to recreate and reinvigorate classic horror movies and use modern styles and techniques of genres that I particularly enjoy and I think everyone likes.
Well, I was on the fence for it at the beginning. It's been a good chat. and you've made some very good points. And I'm still teetering somewhat on the fence of whether to include it. That was until you dropped in that you used this film as a way of basically trolling your unsuspecting house guests by making them sit down and spend 90 minutes watching a thoroughly unpleasant, albeit masterfully made, wonderfully acted, and visually striking, gory, genre-spanning film. So that, almost that alone, as well as the many fine points that you have made, I think that tips the scale. And with that, it's with a sense of trepidation, it has to be said, actually, that I will submit Kill List into the High Hat Hall of Fame.
Mike, you've made me a very happy man.
Well, you have filled up another half an hour on my podcast, and for that, I cannot thank you enough.
As long as I've filled up half an hour in the lives of your loyal High Hat followers, then it's a great day. It's a great day for film.
You've just made that commute for literally dozens of people that little
literally.
Bit better. Well, okay, figuratively.
Figuratively, yeah.
Figuratively, dozens of people. Theoretically, dozens of people are...
I'm going to download it several times. There's going to be one on my phone, one on my tablet, one on my laptop.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I might even mention it on Facebook.
It'll be the first episode you listen to, you egomaniac.
I've been going through most of the episodes that I missed. Mm-hmm. I particularly enjoyed Nick's attempts to mispronounce the name of Anthony Burgess, the author of Clockwork Orange.
I forgot about that.
That made me so happy. I wish you hadn't corrected him and he would have continued saying it, but I did enjoy Burgess.
Yeah, that was good. All right. Well, it is great to have it on the list. I think, it's sitting alongside Princess Mononoke, Fight Club, The Big Lebowski, Theater of Blood. It's a good list. We're building it up there, and it's gonna, when we finally finish construction on like our Hall of Fame, when the actual physical building is finished, it's gonna take pride in place on the mantle as film number 5 in there. So congratulations to you, Mr. Andy Fennick.
Thanks very much, Mike. I envisage a Wild Stallions-esque future where the Hi-Hat Film Podcast has reshaped society, and the Hi-Hat Hall of Fame wing of Hi-Hat Towers will probably be the focal point of humanity.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers, Andy. Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Doesn't feel wrong. They're bad people. They should suffer. Used to love looking at fires when I was a kid.
Well, after all that talk of hunchbacks and infanticide, I've had to remove myself to the chill lounge located in a secluded wing of the High Hat headquarters, where I'm listening to some ambient music and sipping some herbal tea in an effort to lower my heart rate. Well, that's about it for this week's episode of the High Hat Film Podcast. Tune in next time when we will have another High Hatter making a case for a film they love to join the High Hat Hall of Fame, where it will sit forevermore alongside such works as The Big Lebowski, Princess Mononoke, Theatre of Blood, Fight Club, and now Kill List. If you would like to come on the podcast and submit a film for consideration into the Hall of Fame, and after recent submissions, something that doesn't involve the spilling of gallons of blood would be a nice welcome change, then feel free to get in touch on the High Hat Film Podcast Facebook page. That's facebook.com/High Hat Film Review. You can also follow me on Twitter @ClancyHiHat and check out all the old episodes and some written reviews at highhatfilmreview.tumblr.com. And finally, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and if you feel so inclined, leave a little review, because apparently that helps a great deal. Until then, thanks very much for listening. I'll see you next time here on the High Hat Film Podcast.
thought about what you said to me the other day about my painting. Stayed up half the night thinking about it. Something occurred to me. I fell into a deep, peaceful sleep and haven't thought about you since. You know what occurred to me?
No.
You're just a kid. You don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about.
Why, thank you.
It's all right. You've never been out of Boston.
Nope.
So if I asked you about art, you'd probably give me the skinny on every art book ever written. Michelangelo. You know a lot about him. Life's work, political aspirations, him and the Pope, sexual orientation, the whole works, right? I bet you can't tell me what it smells like in the Sistine Chapel. You've never actually stood there and looked up at that beautiful ceiling. Seen that. If I ask you about women, you'd probably give me a syllabus of your personal favorites. You may have even been laid a few times. But you can't tell me what it feels like to wake up next to a woman and feel truly happy. You're a tough kid. I ask you about war, you'd probably throw Shakespeare at me, right? Once more into the breach, dear friends. But you've never been near one. You've never held your best friend's head in your lap and watch him gasp his last breath looking to you for help. I ask you about love, you'd probably quote me a sonnet. But you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. Known someone that could level you with her eyes. Feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you. Who could rescue you from the depths of hell. And you wouldn't know what it's like to be her angel. To have that love for her be there forever. Through anything. Through cancer. And you wouldn't know about sleeping, sitting up in a hospital room for 2 months, holding her hand. Because the doctors could see in your eyes that the terms visiting hours don't apply to you. You don't know about real loss, because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself. I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much. I look at you, I don't see an intelligent, confident man. I see a cocky, scared, shitless kid. But you're a genius, Will. No one denies that. No one could possibly understand the depths of you. But you presume to know everything about me because you saw a painting of mine. You ripped my fucking life apart. You're an orphan, right? Do you think I'd know the first thing about how hard your life has been? How you feel? Who you are? Because I read Oliver Twist. Does that encapsulate you? Personally, I don't give a shit about all that, because you know what? I can't learn anything from you. I can't read in some fucking book. Unless you want to talk about you, who you are, then I'm fascinated. I'm in. But you don't want to do that, do you, sport? You're terrified of what you might say. You move, Chief.